run a small business. I've always run small businesses. I've been an entrepreneur for the best part of 15 years. And I actually set up my first business to help fast-moving, fast-growing entrepreneurs in the late 90s use some of the skills and tools and techniques that big companies use to grow themselves to grow. And I still work with entrepreneurs. I still coach entrepreneurs to give you a little sense of where I've been. My company, WeCreate, works with organizations and leaders to innovate collaboratively. And we do that through training and coaching and design work, designing organizational systems to be able to collaborate, which is actually more difficult than it sounds. Work with a lot of small companies, work with a lot of big companies too, and more I've been working with this kind of bunch, governments, non-profits, charities, people working on what I call purpose-driven innovation, purpose-driven enterprise, a purpose beyond profit. So I'm going to talk about the collaborative economy, what it means. So just a little reminder what economy means. We hear it all the time. I remember growing up, we really never talked much about the economy. It wasn't a big deal. Economists weren't pop stars like they are now. And then sort of fast forward 15, 20 years, and everyone puts the economy after every single word, it seems. So what does a collaborative economy mean? Well, an economy itself is around the production and management and allocation of resources and wealth. That's what economy actually means. And what has been interesting to me as I've studied the collaboration movement, the network movement, is that we're actually on an evolutionary process from different forms of organization. And what I'm going to share with you is why the collaborative economy is not something that's a fad. It's not here for a few years and we're going to go away. It's a long-term movement in how we structure our society and therefore our businesses and organizations within society. So we basically moved from a focus around tribes, and if you think of class as a kind of a tribe, so we had a focus around tribes for a while. Then hierarchies were born from individual power players, kings, queens, aristocrats, dictators. Then for the last 30 years certainly, and a little bit before that, we've had a focus on a market economy and what that means. And we're now emerging into what people call a networked economy or a collaborative economy. So in the tribal economy, resources and wealth end up being given to the strong. Wherever the strong are, we give them our wealth and resources. In a hierarchical economy, resources and wealth are taken by those in power. That could be an absolute monarch, a king. I always think of Louis the 16th when I think of hierarchy. Or it could be people in positions of wealth power. In a market, which is where we've been for a while, resources and wealth flow towards those who are industrious and ingenious. That's what the market works when it's working at its best. And also, of course, banks and venture capitalists. We shouldn't forget those. And of course, what we can see is actually our society now is really a mixture of all three of them. We do have a market economy where if you are hardworking and you have ideas, you can make money and you can raise your status and your capacity to do things. But we also have a hierarchical economy working as well, and we also have a tribal economy working too. So these three things are all working at the same time. So what happens when we then have a networked or collaborative economy? What does that mean? What does it look like? So I'm going to take you through some of the changes that are going on now. And at the end of the session, hopefully, we'll have more of an idea of what a collaborative economy might be like. So, why collaboration? Why collaborative? This is a sense of what's happened in the last 24 hours since this time yesterday morning. This is what's been going on. 1 billion or more content pieces have been added to Facebook. That's a lot of content. 70,000 hours of YouTube videos have been uploaded. If you think about what that compares to the amount of hours made by the television companies of the world, you start to get a sense of the scale of change from those in traditional forms of power and those in the forms of network power. 3 billion YouTube videos have been viewed. Who's watched a YouTube video in the last 24 hours? Fair few. Who's watched more than one? Excellent. 3 video users, they now estimate that per internet user per day, people are watching 3 videos per day. 30 million iPhone apps and Facebook apps have been downloaded. 500 million Skype calls have been used. Who's made a Skype call in the last 24 hours? 100,000 new LinkedIn members in the last 24 hours, 100,000 new internet users. The statistics from India just alone is driving internet growth through the roof. 300 billion emails were sent. 16 billion SMS messages were sent. And you ask yourself, well, so what? What's going on with all this communication, all this talking? I believe it's a revolution. I believe it's been a revolution for the last 50 years, and we're only just starting to see some of the fruits of that revolution. So I was working with dot-coms in 1998, 1999, and I knew there was something big going on. I didn't quite understand it fully, but I had a real deep sense of it. I had so much of an interest, an intrigue, that I left a very large advertising agency and set up a very small company to try and help dot-coms grow. Because the traditional forms of consulting and agencies didn't really understand what they were trying to do. They didn't really understand quite how fundamental the business model change has been when you move into a new form of society. And I believe that the revolution we're going through at the moment will have a longer term and far wider impact than the political revolutions that shook the world from the 1780s and onwards. Which is a bold statement. Clay Shirky is a big thinker in this space. Says a revolution doesn't happen when society adopts new tools. It happens when society adopts new behaviours. 50 years ago, we were adopting new tools. The web, email, sort of working through stuff. We're now starting to adopt new behaviours that come from that. And collaboration is one of them. I believe it's been driven by the web, but it's not actually about the web. It's about the spirit of the times. There's a zeitgeist that the web has opened up that allows us to break down some of those barriers between people in power and people like us who are just trying to create something. And when you can see Rupert Murdoch's Twitter feed, and when you can hear about things that you would never usually hear about, even 10 years ago, you wouldn't get access to the kind of information about who does what in positions of power, things start to really shift. But it's not been just about the web. It's about a sense of participation that we've always had. As we'll see a little later, I believe human beings are naturally designed to participate. It's what we do best. It's one of our fundamental features of our species. It's what allowed us to go from being in small little bands of hunter-gatherers to the civilizations we have now. We had to do it through participation. We couldn't do it alone. It was then hijacked by people, the strong and the greedy. For many, many years, our collective efforts were hijacked by people. And now we've got them back again. And it's very, very exciting to be part of that. Because we have an intrinsic human nature to create, share, and connect. We all do it. We want to do it all the time. In 5 millennia, it's been estimated we've gone from using 100 watts per day of energy and literally 3 or 4 tools. A little stone, something to prize open. Prize off things, to 100,000 watts per day, and 10 to the power of 10 tools available to us on any given day. In 5,000 years, all down to our natural desire to create, to connect, to show other people what we've created. It's a very, very natural thing to be a creative entrepreneur. Predicting the future of the internet is very easy. Anything it hasn't dramatically transformed, it will. People, companies, investors, and even countries can't stop this transformation. The only choice you have is whether you join the side of innovation and progress or you don't. I still work with people who are still resisting the transcendence of traditional forms of power by this network participatory culture. And it won't be long before everyone realizes you are really either on the bus or off the bus. An example of what's been happening in the Middle East in the last year has been fascinating to see that there are mindsets that just can't get with the fact that when it's over, it's over. And the military leaders of Egypt, who took over after Mubarak was toppled by people power, still thought they could carry on doing the same thing that they had been before, but just with a different leader. And again, more people power, more fighting, more participation, more connectivity. So these hierarchies are being dissolved in a globalized participatory network society. You're even seeing things in North Korea shifting because of this transmission of information between people. The brother of the current president writing a book with a Japanese journalist through email about what it's really like there and what his brother's going to be like. I mean, fascinating, fascinating things happening. What it means is all these verticals, Tim was mentioning earlier, these verticals are breaking down. the vertical walls that stop us just talking, just stop us having conversations. They're coming down. Silos are being blurred, silos of within organisations, but more importantly, silos between different types of organisations are being blurred. You're now hearing about people like Nokia and Vodafone working with Oxfam to develop new projects together, to share ideas and share information. And what you start to see is three parts of the economy coming together: the private sector, the public sector, and the not-for-profit sector. I thought I had to stay in the same kind of decade or theme. But what it means is you actually get a great opportunity. You get the private sector, who, as we know, are adaptive, incredibly adaptable, speedy beyond all belief, and ingenious. One of the great things, I do a lot of talking about entrepreneurship, I love being an entrepreneur, and one of the things I love about it is I can wake up in the morning, I can have an idea, and by the end of that day I can make that idea happen in some way, in some form. Started a conversation, sketched out a product, developed a relationship that might make it happen, spoken to someone about getting some funding for it. In a day. The ability to do that is what makes entrepreneurship such a powerful force for change in the world. You've got the private sector, the public sector, but when it works well, can scale ideas. NHS Direct was started as a very small little offshoot, and it was scaled by the NHS, so it touches every one of our lives. Who, before it was changed, who used NHS Direct? Okay. Anyone who's got small kids, it's a godsend. For stopping you go to the unnecessary trips to the hospital. Public sector is also about justice, about some way creating some form of justice for everyone, some kind of social justice. And when it works well, it's got about talking about vision. As Kevin mentioned before, a vision for what it could be like for an entire area, region, country, world. And of course, the public sector, the third sector, which has grown so much recently and I work with a lot, when it works best, it's about compassion for other people, and passion. There's nothing like a social entrepreneur or a non-profit leader to inspire passion in people, a passion for what can be done. It's about independence from anyone else, and about citizenship, some kind of collective. And what you see is also some shadow sides of these three areas. So at its worst, the private sector is short-termist, three-month profit goals, greedy and irresponsible. As we see some of the impacts of that happening in one of my old clients, Tesco's, at the moment. Public sector, when it's at its worst, is oppressive. It shows amazing inertia and can be very, very wasteful. Some things I've seen over the last few years have stunned me, the amounts of money that get wasted on things that don't create change or impact. And the third sector, at its worst, can be righteous, ineffectual, and riddled with vested interests, which shift its purpose and shift its a potential to make change. But what happens if we take the three best parts of these three sectors and we start to bring them together? You've got the ingenuity and speed and agility of the entrepreneurs. You've got the ability to scale those ideas that the public sector can bring, and the ability to keep everything sort of somehow morally right that the third sector brings with us. Some sense of connectivity about shared purpose and shared equity. And that's what the network society offers us. It doesn't happen as much as it could, but I think you'll start to see this occurring as we move forward. Companies working with charities, working with government to make things happen. Here's an example from Unilever in India that works with private sector, third sector, and the government to reach literally the village level of rural India. To make change in those areas. I think we all need to come together if we're going to create the solutions to the problems we face, because the problems are immense. I'm not going to dwell on them, but we have immense problems over the next 20 years. And the only way we can do it is to share our talents and share our resources. So the power to make change, the power to create impact, is increasingly becoming forced to the edges. I remember, and it was only 15 years ago I left university, the milk round was kind of the big thing, the civil service program was the big thing. I mean, no one was an entrepreneur. No one thought about being an entrepreneur. It was a tiny little thing. Everyone thought it was pretty odd. Because people want power. People want status. They want to go to Goldman Sachs. They want to be in the Foreign Office really quickly. And now you start to see people coming out of university, and the first thing they want to do